content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Steve Lord from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a half hour of captivating developments in science, medicine, technology, and the world around us, as reported in Discover, the magazine of science. Today's episode from the May 2018 issue of Discover features the word seiche and three stories on the Kentucky Derby, identifying new animal species, and how Pluto got its name. That word you heard. Seiche. S-E-I-C-H-E. Seiche. Ever notice how when you take a bath, the water sloshes around when you move? The same thing happens when you scoot a cup of liquid around on a table. That sloshing movement happens on a large scale, too, in lakes and bays. It's called a seiche, French for to sway back and forth. When the weather is calm, most of these bodies of water are pretty placid. But when winds pick up, when atmospheric pressures change quickly, or even when there's enough seismic activity like an earthquake, it pushes water around, often away from the shore. In extreme cases, water retreats for so long that many people mistake it for a tide. Digging into Derby Day. What science has to say about America's most popular horse race. The first Saturday in May might be an excuse to indulge in a few mint juleps, but the 1.25-mile Kentucky Derby is a major athletic event. For the 20 horse and rider teams, and everyone from owners to trainers, there's a $2 million purse, and a lot of prestige, on the line. So naturally, experts have dissected nearly every aspect of the race to try to figure out a winning formula. Jockeying for the lead. The extreme posture a rider uses, the so-called martini glass, helps ensure the horse doesn't waste extra energy to ferry the pair to the finish line. According to a 2009 science study, the cramped form uncouples the jockey's movements from that of their steed, and keeps the rider steady. The classic straight-backed posture, on the other hand, requires the horse to move its pilot up and down, which takes a toll on speed. This upright technique was the norm until around the late 19th century, when jockeys who tried the martini glass started winning. The switch in stances led to a 5-7% improvement in race times. The power of the pack. Some horses love to lead right out of the gate, and others trail first and surge ahead later on. But there's a benefit to sticking with the pack. A study published in the Royal Society of Biology Letters in 2012 analyzed roughly 3,300 races and found that horses that stay back just a bit and let other horses cut their wind resistance or draft can decrease their aerodynamic drag by 13%. Drafting for 75% of the race could conserve enough energy to help the horse finish 3-4 places higher than horses that don't draft. The right genes. For generations, horse racing's bread and butter has come down to bloodlines. But now, many experts are looking closely at specific genes, especially the so-called speed gene. Despite its nickname, this gene doesn't actually indicate how fast a horse runs, but rather how far it likes to run. MSTN, as it's formally known, encodes for a protein called myostatin, which is involved in muscle growth. Horses that have what's called a CC variant of this gene are among the sprinters, better at running distances of 0.8 mile or less. Those with the TT variant are the marathoners, best suited for running long distances of at least 1.3 miles. And horses with a CT genotype shine in mid-distance races, like the Derby. Track tried and true. The dirt course at Churchill Downs, where the Derby takes place, is engineered to be as safe as possible for the equestrian elite that thunder around the famous track. 1. 3-inch top layer. Fluffed before every race, it helps decelerate the horse's hooves as they contact the ground. 2. 5-inch cushion. The heavier particles of the mixture tend to settle here, giving horses' hooves something to dig into as they push off the ground. 3. 8-inch mixture. Rarely disturbed, helps maintain a consistent foundation for the specialized mixture of the upper layers. 4. 12-inch clay base. Supports the upper layers and hasn't been disturbed for years. 5. 25-foot sub-base, mix of sand and silt. The foundation for all the above layers. It also promotes proper drainage of the track. A winning combination. The mix of sediments in these three layers is, in the words of Goldilocks, just right. The variety in both the sediments themselves and the size of their particles helps ensure a couple of things. That the track isn't too hard, which would damage the horse's legs, and that it isn't too soft, which would mean more work for the racers to propel themselves forward, much like how we struggle to run in dry sand. The Animal Collective. Scientists race to sample undiscovered species before they vanish, even as many sit on museum shelves. Philippe Boucher is a modern-day bio-explorer and liaison for undiscovered species. He leads wildlife collecting expeditions to far-off corners of the world, bringing along international groups of up to 150-plus. These companions are basically anyone, field researchers, divers, and field collectors, who can best aid Boucher to achieve his primary goal, gathering as many animal and some plant specimens as possible. The success of a field expedition is not so much to bring a suite of the best experts, he says. You may be the best academic on a group of shrimps or shells or worms, but in the field be completely lost. Boucher is chasing little-known and previously undiscovered species, especially bugs, mollusks, and crustaceans. Many explorer biologists have come before him, rounding up species and delivering their finds to museum collections around the world. From there, the specimens often sit unidentified, sometimes for decades, awaiting study. Researchers say it will likely take centuries to fully identify the species already in collections. So instead, Boucher sends the creatures he collects directly to the experts. Beyond fundamental scientific curiosities, the efforts have practical benefits, such as aiding in pharmaceutical advances. The work is also creating a historical record of Earth's fleeting biodiversity. Scientists estimate thousands of species are lost annually due to the human-caused sixth mass extinction. Boucher, a 64-year-old professor at the Muséum National d'Histoire Naturelle in Paris, compares the work to cataloging a dying language. You interview the elders, you make movies, you record their voices, you record their talking stories, you make a dictionary, perhaps, he says, but the language is going to die. Boucher has gone on dozens of biodiversity expeditions since his first as a student in 1974. Today, his field trips stand out because of the volume of harvested specimens and the streamlined efficiency from collection to delivery to the appropriate expert. It's almost on an industrial level, says Ward Appletens, who studies the worldwide distribution of marine species for UNESCO's Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission. Appletens is well aware of the collection backlogs that Boucher is trying to avoid. In a 2012 study, Appletens and other experts estimated that between 58,000 and 72,000 unidentified marine specimens are sitting in collections awaiting analysis. And that's just sea creatures. A separate 2012 study, co-authored by Boucher, found that the average new species sits on the shelf for 21 years before it's described. The study's most extreme example? A broad-banded temple pit viper from Indonesia at Vienna's Natural History Museum took 206 years before it was identified. To be honest, I don't think the backlog is decreasing in any way, Appleton says. Nonetheless, he sees the alternative as much worse. It makes sense, of course, to try to collect as many specimens that you think are undescribed before they all disappear. If Boucher were in the business of funneling his finds only to museums, their collections would certainly see an influx. On a 2012-2013 trip he helped lead to Papua New Guinea, for instance, collectors picked up about 1 million marine specimens and 500,000 terrestrial ones, almost all invertebrates, as well as a few hundred plants. Boucher's teams work meticulously to sort their finds by taxonomic rank. Class, gastropodia, snails, slugs, and the like, to order, neogastropodia, certain species of sea snails, to family, drillidii, smaller predatory sea snails whose shells have long spires. Other explorer collectors aren't as fastidious in their sorting, which is problematic because the experts often don't have time to do it themselves, Boucher says. If you want it to be studied, he says, it must be sorted. Among those who receive pre-sorted collections of specimens is Philip Fallon, an independent researcher based on Long Island who specializes in sea snails. Boucher sent Fallon 4,300 specimens collected during a 2016 expedition to the Caribbean island of Martinique. Through careful study and examination, Fallon was able to pick out 152 distinct species, including 78 new to science. It'll be very interesting if 15, 30 years from now, people can find these very same species, Fallon says. It's a measure of what is there now, and hopefully they'll survive. Boucher, a malacologist, or expert on mollusks, has personally described hundreds of new species, but his career is now focused on expeditions. I like to say that my specialty is to have none, he explains, adding that his specialty is to be a generalist and to bring people together. As a longtime seafarer, he recognizes the growing peril, decreasing oxygen and rising water temperatures and acidity, that species face in such environments. Yet he's most concerned with land and freshwater wildlife, because humanity's impacts there are more immediate. For example, climate change can't really disturb lush rainforest ecosystems in Borneo if humans have already clear-cut the island to farm palm oil, he says. Charismatic animals there include orangutans, elephants, and sun bears. But Boucher says he worries more about the small invertebrates because they often go extinct at faster rates and don't attract funding for recovery programs, protected areas, or reintroductions. Collection and cataloging, then, are often the sole practical means for future study of many species, he says. Keeping a dead animal in a museum collection is often the only thing, the only cost-effective thing, that you can preserve. But the animals Boucher collects aren't always easy to identify. Beyond learning their physical characteristics, becoming an expert in a certain type of creature can require deep dives into historical literature, with some texts going back centuries and written in foreign languages. It can also mean exploring museums around the world. We don't always look the same, Appleton says. Not everybody is born with 10 fingers. It can happen that you collect a specimen that just has 8 fingers. Doesn't mean it's a new species. Because there isn't an expert for all types of creatures, Boucher's specimens do sometimes end up on the collection shelf. But the fruits of his labors are evident. Over the last decade, he estimates 20% of new marine species described worldwide have come from his expeditions. And he hopes this work, finding new species, can spur movement toward better conservation. It's a race against extinction, Boucher says. That is absolutely certain. How Pluto got its name. The public suggestions for naming the new planet ranged from the scientific to the personal, revealing a glimpse into the social mindset of the day. The staggering media attention lavished on New Horizons' flyby of Pluto in July 2015 demonstrated the public's ongoing fascination with all things Pluto. This distant neighbor from the dark and remote regions of our solar system may be physically diminutive compared with other planetary worlds, but it outshines many of them in terms of public interest and sentiment. This captivation dates back to Pluto's discovery in 1930 at Lowell Observatory, when a spellbound public overwhelmed observatory staff with letters and telegrams offering congratulations and often colorful suggestions of what to name the new planet, known only as Planet X. This correspondence, much of it now preserved in Lowell's new Putnam Collection Center, offers invaluable insight into the issues and prevailing thoughts of the day, while also revealing an intimate glimpse at the personalities of many of the individuals who submitted ideas. One of those suggestions came from Venetia Burney, a schoolgirl from England who enjoyed learning about mythological characters. On the morning of March 14th, while Venetia ate breakfast, her grandfather read to her a newspaper account of the planet's recent discovery. After thinking about the news and reflecting on her knowledge of mythology, she said Pluto, the god of the distant, cold underworld, was an appropriate name for this dark and gloomy place. Her grandfather sent her suggestion, unknown to Venetia, to the British astronomer H. H. Turner, who in turn shared it with Lowell Observatory. This note would be one of hundreds received by the observatory, but stands alone in importance, as indicated in the last paragraph of the May 1, 1930 Lowell Observatory Circular that served as Pluto's christening announcement to planet Earth. Lowell director Vesto Melvin, V.M. Slipher, wrote, "It seems time now that this body should be given a name of its own. Pluto seems very appropriate, and we are proposing to the American Astronomical Society and to the Royal Astronomical Society that this name be given it. As far as we know, Pluto was first suggested by Miss Venetia Burney, aged 11, of Oxford, England." That part of the naming story is well documented in history books and often encompasses the whole tale. However, it is only the misleadingly brief and streamlined conclusion. In fact, the 7 weeks between the March 13th announcement of the planet's discovery and the May 1st naming declaration were frenetic for Slipher and his colleagues. While they tried to focus on astronomical issues relating to the new planet, such as an orbit determination, the public distracted them with surging demands of what to call it. Media bombarded Lowell staff with inquiries about the name, while letters and telegrams poured in from individuals and organizations with often strongly opinionated proposals. This interest spiked even higher when a reporter misquoted Lowell trustee Roger Lowell Putnam as saying the observatory would welcome suggestions for the name. Publications from the Boston Herald to the San Francisco Daily News, Popular Science Monthly, to the Christian Science Monitor carried this story, prompting even more people to join the planet-naming craze. Newspapers and other entities also began holding contests. Monckton Denny of South Haven, Michigan, wrote 4 different letters to the observatory, hoping to enhance his odds of winning a $5 prize. The Paramount Theater in New Haven, Connecticut, ran a naming contest in conjunction with a local paper. Paramount's advertising manager, Ben Cohen, wrote a more self-aware letter to the observatory. The sponsors were not so presumptuous as to promise that the winning name would be given to the new planet. They did promise, however, that the winning names would be forwarded to you for your consideration. Therefore, we respectfully submit to you the contest-winning name for the new planet representing the choice of 200,000 people, Minerva. Meanwhile, Delia Grace Valancourt of Champaign, Illinois, informed the observatory that she had won a similar challenge held by the Chicago Herald and Examiner for her suggestion of Athena, Minerva's Greek counterpart, as the goddess of wisdom. Urged on by the papers and contests, the suggestions swelled. The precise number of letters and telegrams that swamped Lowell is lost to history, but the observatory received hundreds of them, with some 150 offering the name Pluto, according to a note preserved from Lowell's secretary, though most of these are nowhere to be found in the archives. With the circus-like atmosphere surrounding the naming, one can imagine much of this correspondence was simply thrown away. More than 250 letters remain. Many of their authors added fragments of biographical information, so we know they ranged in age from 11 to 78 and included at least 117 men and 86 women. The pool of proposers consisted of students and teachers from elementary school through college, attorneys, ministers, a U.S. senator, and even a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy. The letters and telegrams came from 37 of the then 48 states, plus the Alaskan Territory, with the most from Massachusetts, 49, New York, 36, and Pennsylvania, 24. Suggestions also arrived from Canada, Germany, Korea, England, and Mexico. They proposed a total of 171 different names, with 13 listed at least 5 times. Ancient deities dominate this list, following the tradition of planet naming. Of these, 6 are male and 4 are female. Many of the latter suggestions came from the increasingly vocal female population, whose status in society was enjoying dramatic improvement at the time. One letter suggested 6 possibilities: Athena, Juno, Psyche, Circe, Cassandra, and Atalanta, and was signed Star Rover. She is not a feminist. The author wrote, "For ages, men have been the lords of creation. Now that women are striving for the top of the world, it would be regarded as a compliment to the sex to give the new planet a feminine name. It might encourage further exalted aspirations." Another theme of the times, the pursuit of peace, stands out thanks to the multiple suggestions of pax and peace. Walter Nikoff, a student at Lafayette College in eastern Pennsylvania, compellingly captured this sentiment in his letter to the observatory. "The centuries of the past have been stained with the blood of many dreadful wars. Now the world is experiencing a great change. We are in the beginning of an era that shall be known to our posterity as the beginning of the solution for perpetual world peace. The eyes of all men are now looking toward that goal with a hope as never before." Some names referred to recent technological advances. Florence Wolfe of Philadelphia wrote, "Why not give it a modern name? The other planets are mostly named for the ancient gods and were discovered in ancient time. As this is a modern discovery, why not name it for the greatest force of the modern age, electricity?" Florence Howie of Houston offered the name Mazda to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Thomas Edison's invention of the light bulb. William Von Arx of Brooklyn liked Aeronautics because astronomers had worked to find Planet X during the era of flight. Meanwhile, Dr. E.K. Collier of Bowie, Texas, went a step further and suggested Percival Lindbergh, or Percival Lind, in honor of Percival Lowell, who spurred the hunt for Planet X, and American hero Charles Lindbergh, who still garnered headlines 3 years after his historic flight across the Atlantic. Literature, both ancient and modern, inspired some suggestions. Ralph McGoffin of New York City harkened back centuries with Virgilius, in honor of 1930 being the 2000th anniversary of the Roman poet Virgil's works. From more contemporary times, T. Horan of Dalton, Georgia, proposed the awkward-to-pronounce Poitsimi from James Branch Cabell's then-popular but since-faded book, Life of Manuel. Perhaps the most fascinating look into the public consciousness of 1930 can be seen in the hodgepodge of names that defy any other classification. Howard Carter's 1922 discovery of the tomb of King Tutankhamun was still in the mind of Josephine T. of Harlbert, Michigan, when she suggested Shu, the Egyptian god of the atmosphere, as recently found by Mr. Howard Carter in the annex of the Tutankhamun tomb. Even Prohibition, begun in 1920 but winding down by 1930, made an appearance in the name game. Philip Bowman of Annapolis, Maryland, suggested Bacchus, the Roman god of winemaking, as typical of the age we live in. The literary magazine suggested, "For this notable cosmic catch, completing the big league planetary nine, it would be fitting to call the starry outfielder Babe Ruth." Ruth was then near the end of his baseball career, but still a larger-than-life figure. Many of the names honored individuals associated with Planet X, particularly Lowell. These include simply Lowell or Percival, but also combinations such as Persilo, Perlo, and Perlo with a W, the first letters of his first and last name, and Perseus, Percival and his country, the United States. Gail Dismukes of Juneau, Alaska, wanted to honor the discoverer of the new planet, Clyde Tombaugh, with the name Tomboy. She even included a poem. The planet speaks. Tomboy, Tomboy, let it be my name. Surely Mr. Tombaugh beats in this game. Playing hide-and-seek, I often have thought, I should like to be discovered by one self-taught. Let the joyous tidings ring the world around. Tomboy, Tomboy, the latest planet found. One of the cutest ideas came from Carl Underhill of New Hampshire. He wrote, "If I had discovered the new trans-Neptunian planet, I would name it Jean, after my 2-year-old baby girl. I do not know the definition of the name Jean, but it means everything to me. This letter is not a crank." While many of the other suggestions undoubtedly made for good reading, the Lowell staff ultimately chose Pluto. Putnam gave a press statement explaining the decision to go with a Roman god in accordance with the other planets. He said, "There have been many suggestions which have been weighed and sifted, and suitable ones were narrowed down to 3, Minerva, Cronus, and Pluto. Minerva was the staff's first choice, but since an asteroid already bore the goddess's name, they decided on Pluto, the god of the regions of darkness where X holds sway." Putnam pointed out that Pluto's 2 mythological brothers, Jupiter and Neptune, were already represented by solar system planets. Now one is found for him, Pluto, and he at last comes into his inheritance in the outermost regions of the sun's domain. 85 years after Pluto's discovery and naming, public fascination with this icy body remains strong. These days, instead of suggesting names for the body itself, people are thinking of names for Pluto's geographical and geological regions, again pulling ideas from mythology, pop culture, and the real scientists and visionaries involved with the Pluto system. What will future generations glean from the current wave of naming choices? Whether because Pluto was long considered the only planet discovered in the United States, or because so many people regard it as an underdog, it remains beloved in the hearts of many in the population. Given this warm regard, plus the heart-shaped region the New Horizons team imaged and later dubbed Tombaugh Regio, perhaps Solomon Berman of Washington, D.C., writing to the observatory in 1930, offered the best and most prescient name. Amor. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover, the magazine of science. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. Till then, expand your mind. I'm Steve Lord, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.